This is Mary Lee for Talking Information Radio on June 1st, reading Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, November-December 2025 issue. This story is called Take Me for a Ride by Michael Mallory. The story took up most of the front page of the Los Angeles Herald Express. Bugsy Siegel murdered, the headline screamed, daring any reader to notice that Finland was chosen to host the 1952 Olympics 5 years hence, or that the Senate battled through a contentious all-night session. Would stamping Bugsy's passport to the afterlife make Los Angeles a safer place to live? Jim Beckley doubted it. As he was perusing the inside of the paper, a knock rattled the glass of his office door, which was on the second floor of an old building in the neighborhood of Los Feliz. Opening it, Jim cried, "Good God, Sanders," upon seeing the shortish, muscular man standing in the hallway. "Hiya, Sarge," Osgood Goody Sanders said, grinning at his former platoon mate. He held out his hand, which Jim shook and then used to pull him into the office. Corporal Goody Sanders was the kind of soldier every unit needed, the guy who could keep any motor vehicle running. He had been the one who figured out how to keep the tank's treads from getting bogged down in the mud in Europe by reinforcing them with wooden planks. "Have a seat, Corporal," Jim said, motioning him to the only one in the office not behind his desk. "What are you up to these days?" "Got my own garage in Silver Lake," Sanders replied. "I got cars coming in and out all the time." "There's a shock." "Yeah, I always wanted my own place. I worked at a gas station for 8 months and saved every nickel I could. Built up a reputation, too. Then I finally found a place and opened up for business." "That's great," Jim said. "As you can see, things have changed a little for me. The last thing I expected I'd be doing once I finally decamped was turning into Philip Marlowe, but it turns out I have kind of a knack for it." "Yeah, that's why I'm here." Jim studied his compatriot's blunt, square face. "You have a problem?" "You could say that. Somebody brought in a car last week, a real beauty, like nothing I've ever seen before. The guy said the shifting was getting rough, and he heard about me from somebody. Anyway, it was a 1943 Packard 130 with all the accessories. Thing damn near came with its own kitchen and latrine." "Wait a minute, Goody. You said a 1943 Packard?" Sanders grinned and nodded. "That's what I said. And when the guy, his name's Claude Descanso, told me that, I gave him the horse laugh, too, and asked what kind of con he was trying to pull. One did not have to be an automotive expert to know that no autos of any kind were built in America during the war, freeing up the car makers to concentrate exclusively on the war effort. What was the guy's name again?" Jim asked. "Descanso, Claude Descanso," Sanders replied. "He looked like he should be named Claude Descanso. Tall, thin, slick back hair, pencil mustache, a little prissy. I know if this Claude Descanso was trying to take you for a ride, he wasn't being very clever about it. And I told him that, but he kept insisting I should take a look at the car, whether I believed his claim or not. He said he'd give me all the details later, and since he was willing to pay money in advance, I agreed. And, Sarge, I'm telling you, that was one sweet piece of road eater. Here, let me show you." Reaching into his coat pocket, Sanders pulled out a black-and-white photograph and handed it to Jim. It showed a luxury vehicle in two-tone paint with plenty of chrome and a signature Packard grille and hood ornament. "That was taken in my shop." "Nice," Jim said. "It's even better in person. The sides are pine tree green and the top and hood kind of seafoam with sun-yellow tire sidewalls. Long story short, the car needed some tranny work, like the guy intimated, but otherwise it was in tip-top shape. It was closing time last Thursday when I called Descanso to tell him it was ready, and he said he'd be by in the morning. That was when I mentioned I'd seen parts in the engine that I'd never seen before. He smiled and finally filled me in on the car's secret. Sanders stopped to pull out a pack of cigarettes and light one. "Don't keep me in suspense, Goody. Sorry, but what do you know about Argentina?" "It's somewhere down south." "Well, its government didn't seem to want to get into the war." "Neither did I, but I didn't have much say in the matter," Jim thought. "It seems both of us, I mean the U.S. and England, were pressuring the president of Argentina to cut off his ties with the Axis and side with us. As an incentive, hell, bribe, Roosevelt offered to send El Presidente a one-of-a-kind American luxury car, a make and model no one else on earth had. He personally ordered Packard to make one car and throw in the kitchen sink, but all on the QT. No one was supposed to know this was going on. When the car was finished, film of it being test-driven was sent down to Argentina. And guess what? El Presidente actually did break it off with Hitler and Tojo. I have to assume the car was never delivered to him. Apparently, Roosevelt was holding out for the other boot to drop and for Argentina to declare it was on the side of the Allies. But that didn't happen immediately. A couple of months after telling Schick Gruber to take a flying leap out of a Messerschmitt, El Presidente resigns. The guy who took over as president waited more than a year before signing up with the good guys. Then 2 weeks after that, Roosevelt dropped dead and the whole secret deal fell apart. The car goes into storage, the war ends with a big kaboom, and that's that. Did Descanso say how he got ownership of the car? Jim asked. No, in fact, he specifically stated that was the one question he would not answer. But you believed his story? Well, whether I did or not doesn't really matter at this point. Descanso showed up the next morning right as I was unlocking the garage door, all smiles. That ended when I got the door open. Sarge, the car was gone.
Gone?
Like it was never there. The garage door was padlocked from the inside, just like I left it. There's a back door that goes into an alley, and it was locked from the inside, too. I leaped through the front door to the office, which I locked from the outside. The only way that car could have gotten out was if somebody came in through the front, unlocked the padlock on the garage door, drove out, relocked the garage door, and then exited from the home front again. I'm the only one with the keys. There isn't another set anywhere. What did Descanso do when he was told his car was missing? Jim asked. Oh, Christ, Sarge, he blew a gasket. He started accusing me of theft and said he was going to sue me. I didn't know what to do. Then I came across your ad in the Yellow Pages and saw that you were now a detective. That's the only bit of good luck I've had in the last few days. Have you heard from him since? No, but I expect to any time. Have you gone to the police? No, I imagine telling the cops that story and figured all they'd do is toss me in the tank to sleep it off. What is it you expect me to do, Goody?
Well, find the car for one thing, Sarge. If you can also figure out how someone got through all the locks, got the thing out and then locked the place back up without keys, that would be helpful, too.
Jim Beckley thought in silence for a moment. What he should do was take Goody Sanders out for a beer and then tell him his case sounded incredible, maybe even unsolvable. But he and Goody had been through a lot together. He was the kind of friend you made in a life-or-death situation. Finally, he said, all right, Goody, I'll take you on as a client, but on one condition. Name it. That you call me Jim. Sarge is folded up in my closet at home. All right, Jim, you don't need money up front, do you? Let's wait on that until I can get your client contract written up. Right now, how about taking me to your garage so I can look around? With Sanders' blue Ford coupe in the lead, the two convoyed in separate cars down to Sunset Boulevard, where the garage was located. It was a small establishment set back from the street to make room for a parking lot, which was nearly full. The lot was surrounded by a cyclone fence topped with barbed wire. You can't be too careful, Sanders said. You didn't mention the fence, Jim said. This has a locking gate, too, I presume.
Right, I forgot about that.
So whoever took the car had to first get through this gate, then into the garage itself, and you're certain there isn't another set of keys?
Positive.
Okay, let's go. The inside of Goody Sanders' garage looked like the inside of any garage. There were tools and parts strewn everywhere, grease on the concrete floor, and a girly calendar, which Jim presumed were mandatory before a business license for an auto shop would be granted in the city. There was only one car inside, a dark red Nash Ambassador with much of its engine missing. Taking out the photo Sanders had given him, Jim held it up against the building until he lined up the camera position. It didn't tell him anything except that the photo had indeed been taken inside the garage, and the luxury car filled up most of it. You don't have any employees? Jim asked.
Nah, just me.
You think someone might have used a lockpick?
It's technically possible, but the thief would have had to pick the padlock on the gate, open it, come in, pick the front door lock, go in, pick the padlock on the garage door, open it, drive the car out, then go back and lock everything up again, including the front gate lock, before driving away. Which raises one other big question. How did the thief start the ignition?
I left the key inside the car, Goody said. I didn't want to lose it. That was pretty dumb.
You weren't expecting it to get stolen, Jim said, but maybe it's a good thing you did.
How can it be good? Well, think about it. There's no way the thief could have known you'd left the ignition key in the car
when he broke through the first lock, so he had to have some other plan to start it. There's always hot wiring, or popping out the ignition and starting it up with a screwdriver. Anyone with a good knowledge of cars could do either of those. That's what I'm saying. Whoever took it must have had a good knowledge of cars and engines. Another garage owner? Have you had any trouble lately with another mechanic? No, Sandra said, shaking his head. I haven't been open long enough to make enemies. Okay, Jim said. I'm going to need to talk to this Descanso guy. I've got his number on the desk. Sanders walked over to a small desk shoved up against the far wall and began riffling through the pile of papers stacked on top of it, nearly obscuring the old candlestick phone that rested on the edge. It's here somewhere, he called back, unless I stuck it in the pocket of my overalls. Jim fished out a business card and carried it over to his friend. I'll tell you what. When you find the number, call me. And if the guy shows up in person, try to keep him here and then call me. Will do, Sarge. I mean, Jim. I'll give you one of my cards, too. Once more, he searched through the papers, finally muttering, I know I have some here someplace. Instead of waiting, Jim Beckley pulled out a small notepad and pen and wrote down the number on the phone. I can't say this is going to be a snap, Goody, he said, but we'll get this figured out. He shook the man's hand again before taking his leave. Back in his car, a two-door Chevrolet Fleetmaster that he couldn't imagine anyone wanting to steal, he thought about his last words to Sanders and added aloud, I just can't see how. After closing up his office for the day, Jim went home to the small house he shared with Della Hampton. As far as their neighbors knew, they were a happily married couple. The happy part was true. It was the married part that wasn't. Dell had been married to another ex-GI who managed to get himself murdered. That was how she and Jim became acquainted. Not exactly a Hollywood meet-cute moment. As for Jim, his divorce decree was now 5 months old, and the knowledge that he was more than halfway responsible for it made him gun-shy about putting on another ring. The two of them were comfortable the way things stood. The aroma of meatloaf permeated the house when Jim walked in. "Smells great," he told Della, tossing his hat on the seat of a chair, taking off his jacket and draping it over the back, and undoing his tie. "You're not going to make me eat something green, though, are you?" "Not tonight," Della replied. "Tonight is yellow, summer squash." "Hmm," he grumbled. Like so many returned soldiers, Jim Beckley was a meat and potatoes man, though she had fixed something with leaves once that he halfway enjoyed. After they had finished dinner, they jointly washed and dried the dishes, with Della subconsciously humming a song. Jim liked to hear her hum and sing. When she finished, he said, "I got a new case today." "Not a dangerous one, I hope." "No, but a strange one. What do you know about Argentina?" "Isn't that where all the escaped Nazis are hiding?" "That I don't know, but listen to this." He related to her the details of the case as told to him by Goody Sanders, and when he was finished, added, "I don't know how much of that is true, particularly about FDR bribing the head of Argentina, but I do know there's no Packard, 1943 or otherwise, in Goody's garage." "Seems like too bizarre a story to make up," Della said. "Would you like me to go to the library on Monday and do some research into politics in Argentina?" "That would be swell." The two spent Sunday at the Los Angeles Zoo, where Jim absently wondered if the gorilla in the cage might have a better shot at figuring out this crackpot case than he did. But he didn't go into this business just to quit when things became difficult. On Monday morning, Jim went to his office while Della took the bus to Hollywood, which had a large public library branch. When she appeared in his office a couple of hours later, he was studying the photo Goody had given him of the car. "You'll be happy to know," she began, "that your friend's story has a basis in fact." "You discovered something about the car?" he asked. Della pulled a notebook out of her purse and glanced at its pages. "The car, no. As for Argentina, though, it was officially neutral for most of the war, though it leaned towards supporting Germany. The president at that time was named Pedro Pablo Ramirez, and he broke it off with the Axis in January of 1944. He soon thereafter resigned, and his vice president, General Edelmiro Farrell, took over. On March 26, 1945, 6 days after FDR was sworn in for his fourth term, Argentina officially declared war on Germany and Japan, which means Roosevelt could have renewed his promise of the car to General Farrell. Uh-huh. But before long, Farrell was replaced as president by someone named Juan Perón, who's still there. Why was a guy named Farrell running a South American country anyway? Sounds more like a Boston cop. I wondered about that, too, so I looked it up. His grandfather came from Ireland. You were busy.
I was, so does any of this help?
Sure, it makes Goody's story sound a little less screwy, but it doesn't tell me how a car could vanish from a locked garage. I really need to talk to this Descanso character, but I don't know how to get a hold of him.
Wasn't your friend supposed to call you with his number?
He said so, but he probably forgot. Once he gets working on an engine, everything else goes away.
Jim pulled the notepad from his pocket and dialed the number for the garage he'd written down. The phone at the other end rang unanswered.
Why would he not be there, he asked, hanging up.
Maybe he stepped out for lunch.
Maybe. I think I should go over there again. I'll drop you off at home on the way.
Why don't you drop me off at the Owl Drugs on Vermont instead? I'll find my own way home.
Is there something I should know about? Jim asked warily. He and Della not only shared the house, but increasingly the same bed.
Only if you lose sleep over the particular brand of face powder I like, she replied.
Jim dropped her off in front of the drugstore and then proceeded to Sanders' garage. When he got there, he saw the front gate closed but not locked. Going through, he went up to the door, which was also unlocked. The garage was dark inside.
Hello, Goody? Jim called and received no answer.
There was enough sunlight bleeding in for him to find the light switch was turned on the overheads. Looking around, Jim saw that the Nash was still there but was now reassembled. Then he saw something else. A man was lying on the oily concrete in the middle of the shop. Approaching him cautiously, Jim knelt and checked the pulse. Finding none, he was very carefully rolled the man over. It was not Goody Sanders. Neither was it someone who matched Goody's description of Claude Descanso. Only one thing seemed certain. Whoever made the bloody, greasy dent on the guy's head was the cause of his death. Going to Sanders' desk, Jim took out his handkerchief and used it to pick up the candlestick phone, while employing his necktie as protection against getting his fingerprints on the earpiece or smudging those already there. Dialing zero, he instructed the operator to connect him with the Police Homicide Bureau. Once there, he asked for Detective Rand Moreland, who last year had headed up the investigation into the murder of Della's husband. When Moreland answered, Jim said, "This is Jim Beckley, remember me?"
"Hell yes," the voice at the other end said. "I heard you somehow got a license and went into business for yourself."
"That's right, and guess what? I've just stumbled over my second body."
"I guess you haven't been in this racket long enough to know that gumshoes normally protect their clients by remaining silent," Rand Moreland told Jim as the two sat in the detective's office at City Hall. Jim had just finished explaining as much of the case as he felt comfortable disclosing, but described the missing car only as valuable without revealing its background.
"I thought I was protecting Goody by letting you know what's going on before you find him and start grilling him," Jim replied.
"You don't happen to know where he lives, do you?"
Jim shook his head. "I've only been to his place of business." The detective's phone rang. "Moreland," he growled into it.
"Okay, good. What have you got?"
After listening for a minute, he said, "Good work," and hung up. "They've identified the body as Lyman Hundley, 41 years old, unmarried. He worked for Republic Studios in the Special Effects Department. No criminal record as far as anyone can tell. Did your friend Sanders ever mention a Lyman Hundley?"
"No, maybe he was another customer of Goody's. There was a car in the garage, an old Nash."
"And you know nothing about this Claude Descanso?"
"Believe me, I wish I knew where to find him because he seems to be at the center of all of this.
I'll put somebody on him and see if we can dig him up. So how do you like gumshoeing?"
"All right." Della's the one who nudged me into it.
"Della? Oh, right, Hampton's wife. She was really a traffic stopper. How is she?"
"Fine."
"Okay, don't tell me what's going on between you two," Moreland said with a grin. The detective's phone rang again.
"Yeah?" he barked.
"Oh, Christ. All right, thanks." Dropping the receiver into the cradle, he said, "The reporters are on their way up. I don't think you should be part of this."
"Neither do I," Jim said. "I'll slip out the back. If you find your buddy Sanders before we do, you let me know?"
"Right."
Jim left the building and went back to his office, where he tried calling Goody's garage again. This time it picked up.
"Hello, who's this?" a voice answered, not Goody's.
"Is Mr. Sanders there?" Jim asked.
"No, who's calling?"
"I have a car in there for a fuel pump repair," Jim lied. "I wanted to know if it's done."
"Who is it?"
a voice in the background asked.
"A customer, Lieutenant," the man on the phone called back.
"Police," Jim thought. "You sound busy. I'll call back later." After hanging up, He pulled out the photo of the car and began to study it once more, as though it would somehow reveal a clue. It didn't, though there was something wrong with the image, something he couldn't put his finger on. Slipping it back into his breast pocket, he reached into a desk drawer and pulled out the Luger he'd brought back from Europe. He didn't like carrying a gun, but it had been a fact of his life for the past 5 years. His wife, Carol, had absolutely hated the sight of the automatic pistol, which contributed to her decision to leave him. The larger consideration, of course, was her growing fearfulness of his moodiness and drinking, both symptoms of the memories of war which continued to haunt him, though with slightly less frequency now. He spent the next several minutes cleaning the Luger and was still holding the gun when his office door burst open. "Hey, hey, hey," Goody Sanders shouted, throwing his hands up as he saw what appeared to be Jim training the pistol on him. A bandage was wrapped around his right index finger. "You can put your hands down," Jim said, opening his desk drawer and sliding the gun inside. "I was just cleaning it." "Phew," Sanders whistled. "What did you do to your finger?" "Cut it on a piece of glass. But never mind that. Something's going on at my garage. There's cop cars all over the place." "I know. I was there this morning. The gate was unlocked, so I went in and found the front door unlocked. Then I found a corpse on the floor." "Descanso?" "No, somebody named Lyman Hundley. Do you know him?" "Yeah, I know him. He's dead?" "Crud. Hey, the cops don't think I did it, do they?" "Well, they'd certainly like to talk to you, Goody. I called not long ago, and they were still there. Didn't you say anything then?" "I didn't go inside. I was out most of the day buying parts. And when I got back, I saw all these patrol cars, so I just kept going and came straight here." "The longer you stay out of sight, the more convinced the police will be that you had something to do with Hundley's death. Who was he, Goody?" Goody Sanders flopped down in the guest chair, pulled out a handkerchief, and mopped his sweaty face. "You might as well know now," he said. "He's the real owner of the car." "So Claude Descanso was just an agent?" "There is no Claude Descanso. He's a shadow figure Lee and me made up." "A shadow figure?" "Yeah, he's not real. He's just a name, like an alias." "Shadow?" Jim said, pulling the photo of the car back out again and staring at it. "That's it. Something about this picture struck me as not quite right, but I couldn't figure it out. It's obvious now. Even with overhead lights, the car should have cast some kind of shadow on the floor, but it doesn't. It's like it's floating in air. This picture's a fake, isn't it?" "The picture's not a fake." Sanders pulled out a pack of smokes and lit one, "but the car is." "What are you up to, Goody?" Sanders sighed. "Okay, do you know what a hanging miniature is?" "No." "They're models of things like rooms or buildings, and they're used in films. If you don't want to build a full-size castle, say, you make a model of it and then hang it by wires in front of the camera. When lined up right, it looks like a part of the real set. That's a lot cheaper than building a full-sized fake castle on a hill. Lai's job at the studio was to make models like that, as well as bridges to be blown up or cars to fly over cliffs. He was good, too. His stuff looked real. That Packard in the photo is a 2-foot model he strung up and positioned for the camera so that it looked like it was really sitting in the shop. And it looks absolutely real, except that it doesn't cast a shadow." "Yeah, well, in movies, the shots go by so fast you don't get a chance to notice." "All right, now I know how a car could seem to disappear from a locked building, but what was the point of all this?" "The point was to try and keep Lai from getting his legs broken or worse," Sanders said. "Lai and me, we go all the way back to high school. I hadn't seen him for years because I was in uniform. I don't have to tell you that. But he managed to stay out and keep working because of that necessary industry label they put over the film business. He was making good money, too. But he had one problem, the gambling bug. He got in way over his head and started borrowing money from guys he shouldn't. He was desperate to get cash to pay off his debt, so he came up with this scheme to try and sell a one-of-a-kind car to somebody sight unseen. He made up the story about Roosevelt and the president of Argentina. Some drinking buddy of his, who was a writer at the studio and into world politics, helped him with the details. He even had a mark lined up, a producer named Carlson, who was the kind of guy who always tried to show up everybody else by having something they didn't. So the only car of its kind in the world, worth who knows how much, that was the perfect pitch." "And the photo was taken to convince him?" "Yeah, the idea was to get half of the money up front and then have Claude Descanso mysteriously disappear with the car, never to be seen again. 'Cause just half the money Lai was asking for was still pretty damn good. But then something happened and the deal got queered. I don't know how. All I know is that Lai was in a panic because he had to get some dough really fast or else. Out of desperation, he came up with a new scheme. He'd offer the car to the guy who loaned him the money in the first place as payment. But there was no car, Jim said. Right, but we had to make the guy think there was a car. We figured the best way to do that was to get somebody else involved who also believed the car was real but had been stolen and could guarantee Lai's loan shark that he was searching for it. In other words, me, Jim said. Yeah, I'd heard you'd become a private dick, so you seemed perfect. Goody, if this was a movie, by now I'd have walked out and demanded my money back from the cashier. How did you expect to get away with this? What did you think was going to happen when the buyer, no matter who it was, found out the car existed only as a toy? And why not simply tell me the car had been stolen from your lot? Why go to all the trouble of creating a mystery nobody could solve? Because I figured the longer it took you to investigate, the longer it would keep Lai healthy, Sanders replied. The more impossible I made it seem, the better, because there was no way you were going to find a car that didn't exist. I also know you're the kind of guy who doesn't just give up. So if you reported back to the loan shark every week that you were still on the case and refused to drop it, that would be one more week Lai had to try and come up with the money for real. I'm not saying it was a genius plan, but Lai was desperate. Sounds to me like the creditor got wind of what you were doing and took care of Hundley. Do you know who he is? Lai wouldn't say, but maybe it wasn't the shark that killed him. Maybe it was the producer after all. I just don't know. You're going to have to talk to the police about this, you know. Sanders said nothing as he stubbed out his cigarette in the tray on Jim's desk. Look, Goody, I know one of the homicide detectives, and he's a good guy. Could you talk to him then? Sanders asked. Straighten things out with him as a friend? With a sigh, Jim picked up his phone and placed a call to the homicide division. When he got Moreland on the line, he said, Hi, Detective, it's Jim Beckley again. I have Goody, that is, Osgood Sanders, with me, in the office. He's afraid to come down for fear he might be arrested. No, I don't think he killed Hundley. Sure, hold on. He handed the phone to Sanders, who took it reluctantly. Hello? Yes, this is Osgood Sanders. When? Tomorrow? Well, okay. What time? All right, I'll be there. My address? 214 North Virgil. Jim jotted the address down on a piece of paper and also noticed that Sanders gave his shop phone number instead of a home number. All right, thank you, Sanders said. Oh, and do you know when your tubes will be finished at my place? Oh, okay, thanks. He handed the phone back to Jim. I told you it wouldn't be that grueling, Jim said, recradling the receiver. Yeah, and the cops are down at the shop, which is even better. Once Sanders had taken his leave, Jim started to make notes on a sheet of paper. What it amounted to was a scheme fated to end badly. Carlson, Jim muttered, reading over his notes. Obviously, he would not get very far showing up at Metro in Culver City, asking to see a producer. Maybe he could get the guy on the phone. It was a little after four. Surely even a producer would still be at work. He called the operator for the number of the studio, and once there, wended his way through secretary after secretary until he ended up in the office of Ralph Carlson Productions. Mr. Carlson is not here, the woman at the other end of the line said. Who is this, please? My name is Jim Beckley, and I'm calling regarding a 1943 Packard. A 1943 Packard? Didn't they stop making any kind of car after Pearl Harbor? Yes, but when will Mr. Carlson be back? He's expected home the 1st of September. Sorry? He's in England setting up an overseas studio. How long has he been in England? He left last week. I see. He calls in regularly, the secretary said. Shall I leave a message? No, thanks. I'll call back in September. Jim hung up. If Carlson had been in England for a week, he couldn't have killed Hundley. That also explained why the original deal fell through. The mysterious loan shark was now the sole prime suspect. But who was he? It was becoming clear this case would not be wrapped up quickly, if ever, and Jim was still working off the clock. From his desk, he pulled out a folder of printed work agreements and filled in his share of the information necessary for taking Goody on as an official client. He started to address an envelope for it, but then stopped. Maybe it would be better to take the agreement over to Goody in person and also let him know about the Carlson's trip. Picking up the phone, he called Della and told her he had to do some legwork and would probably be late for dinner. Better yet, he said, why don't you take the night off? Go see a movie, maybe, and get a bite out. I'll do the same. You'll go see a movie? She asked in a goofy voice. No, Gracie, I'll get something to eat at a lunch counter. Whatever you're doing, Jim, be careful. You know there are times when I think you really care. In her sweetest voice, Della repeated a phrase she'd heard from the musicians she used to sing with in her former life, which made Jim laugh raucously. He hung up, glad they were not on a party line. She could make him laugh. She also sang, cooked, and when fixed up, she made Gene Tierney look like a boy. Hell, maybe they should think about getting hitched. Getting to his car, Jim first drove to Sanders' shop, only to find the gate locked up and the building dark. The police were indeed gone, but so apparently was Goody. Next, Jim took Sunset Boulevard west to Virgil Avenue and followed the street numbers until he came to the address Goody had given to Moreland. He triple-checked the address and also those of the neighboring buildings. There was no doubt this was 214 North Virgil, but it was not a house or apartment building. It was a small Mexican restaurant. Maybe he'd heard wrong. Goody could have said 240. Jim drove three blocks up until he reached that address at a Richmond station. As much as Goody Sanders loved cars, Jim couldn't imagine him living in a service station. Could he have said 2014? To cover every base, Jim headed toward 2014 North Virgil, where 201 North Virgil would be if it existed. But the street inexplicably turned into Hillhurst at 1200 block. What kind of game are you playing, Goody? Jim wondered aloud. With no other alternative, he returned home, arriving only barely later than usual. Della was already gone. He hoped she was having a good time. Finding a can of chili in the kitchen cabinet, he upended it into a pot and put it on the stove. Then he pulled out the telephone directory and did what he should have done as step number one. Look up Osgood Sanders. There was no listing for Osgood Goody or even O. Sanders. No phone, no address, no Goody, Jim uttered. His impulse was to call Moreland back and find out when Goody was coming in tomorrow, but he doubted the detective would still be there. Going back to the kitchen, he popped open a beer and sat at the small table, eating the chili straight from the pot. It was hardly gourmet, but there were many times when he was sitting in a foxhole somewhere in Europe waiting to be kill or be killed when he would have given anything for a bowl of hot chili con carne instead of some cold, fatty meat from a tin. He was washing the pan when Della got back. I thought you said you were getting a bite out, too, she said. Plans changed, but this was fine. How was the film? I probably should have picked another one. It was a crime drama with Robert Mitchum playing an ex-GI who meets a girl singer in a club and tries to get her away from her mobster boyfriend. That described the situation that had propelled Jim and Della together. Think we should sue for plagiarism, he asked. Sliding her shoes off, she added, at least I never had to endure a nightclub brawl like in the movie, where a guy got a bottle broken over his head and another one was thrown through the window. How's your case coming? I suppose it could be a bigger mess, but I'm not sure how. He related to her the events of the day, then added, I'm going to call Moreland first thing tomorrow and find out when Goody is supposed to come. I think I'll be there, too. He asked about you, by the way. The detective? What did you tell him? That you sing me to sleep every night. She used that old musician phrase again, only in this context it seemed more appropriate. It was sometime between 2:30 and 2:45 in the morning, as Jim was lying in his own bed, half asleep, that he finally got it. He sat straight up, the noise from which awakened Della. What is it, she asked, another nightmare? No, I think some smoke just blew out of my head. He got up and went out to the living room where his jacket rested and retrieved the photo. Then he turned on the light. Studying it closely, he muttered, and there is it, there it isn't. Damn. Now Della appeared in the doorway, squinting against the light. Are you all right, she asked. Yeah, I'm fine. I just figured out a lot of things all at once. Will you be staying up? I want to jot down my thoughts before I forget them. Then I'll come back to bed. 10 minutes later, Jim slid under the covers next to her, his mind clearer than it had been in days. Instead of going back to his own bed, he crawled into Della's. Comforted by her warmth, he fell back asleep. By 7, though, fully awakened in daylight, Jim's wee hours theory seemed almost ridiculous. At least he wanted to believe so. After showering, shaving, and dressing, he put in a call to Moreland, who told him Goody Sanders promised to be there by 10:30. Has the morgue figured out what kind of club was used on Hundley yet? Jim asked. Think so, the detective replied. Tiny glass shards indicate it was a bottle. I figured as much. You figured as much? I'll make a prediction, too. I'll bet Goody's not going to show up. That address he gave you was phony. So where is he? Jim explained his suspicion and the two made plans, then he hung up. After telling Della he had a stop to make before going into the office, he headed out. The gate in front of Goody's garage was still locked, but a quick walk around the block told him what he needed to know. Goody's car was parked on a side street. Going down a dirty alley behind the shop, he saw the back door Sanders had mentioned. Placing an ear against it, he could hear movement inside. Stepping back, Jim waited. About 5 minutes passed before Goody Sanders emerged, carrying a small, battered suitcase. "Hello, Corporal," he said, startling him. "Sarge, what the hell? What do you want? For starters, I'd like to know what that 214 North Vigil business is all about." "Oh, that. Well, it's a place I like to go for a bite to eat." "But you don't live there. You live here." "Here? Well, what are you talking about?" "You told me about this back door that's kept locked from the outside," Jim said. Then pulling out the car photo and holding it up, he added, "The funny thing is, there's no corresponding door on the inside of the garage. Just a solid wall." "How could that be? It couldn't unless the back door opens into a separate space. Like maybe a small apartment?" "Okay, so I live here too." "So why did you give Moorhead the dummy address? And why are you running out?" Jim pointed to the suitcase. "Forget all that, Goody. Just tell me why you killed Lyman Hundley." "Oh, Sarge, I thought we were friends." "We were. That's why I gave you every benefit of the doubt, even when you weren't making any sense at all. Now that things are starting to make sense, I can't simply let you run away." "There's no way you can stop me," Sanders said. "Sorry, Goody, but I think there is," Jim replied, pulling out his gun. "You wouldn't." "I wouldn't like it, but if I have to, I'll blow your little toe off. Make it hard to run. Now get back inside." Forcing him into the building, Jim saw that the room had been turned into a tiny living space, with a cot shoved up against the corner, a table holding a hot plate for cooking, and an ice box. A pipe suspended from the ceiling was filled with empty clothes hangers, the clothes themselves no doubt inside the suitcase. At one end of the space was a narrow door. "Does that lead to the garage?" Jim asked. "It leads to the bathroom, and then Jake's opens into the garage," Sanders said sourly. "That door I keep locked during business hours." Jim closed the door behind him and switched on a light. "Why'd you do it, Goody?" Sanders dropped the suitcase and sat on the corner of the bed. "I never should have gotten mixed up in this," he said. "I ran into Lye in a bar a couple of weeks ago. We hadn't seen each other in years, and we got to talking and drinking, a lot of both. When he found out I had a garage, he got all excited. He said he had a big score that he'd cut me in on. He told me about his job in Hollywood, making models and all, and he explained the scheme to defraud a big rich producer with the model car. Then he confessed he owed a couple grand in gambling debts, and if he didn't pay up in a hurry, he might not live to regret it. He asked if I'd cover the $2,000 for him until his big score came in." "Did you?" "Yeah, I know. How dumb can a guy be? It was literally all the money I had in the bank. But he was an old friend and he was in trouble, so what was I supposed to do? At first, my involvement was simply to lend him the dough and let him hang his car in the garage so he could take a picture. But then I let it slip that I'd learned my old sergeant was now a private detective, and he got excited all over again. He told me to get you involved as a witness that the car had been stolen. I didn't want to, but Lye said if I didn't play along, I'd never get my money back. You still haven't told me why you killed him. I don't know if I can make you understand." "Try." "Well, early Sunday morning, I woke up to hear someone pounding on the door. It was Lye, and he was in a state. He'd found out that his mark, the producer, was out of the country, so the deal was off. At least it was delayed, but Lye was running out of time. He said he was just going to skip before they got to him. So I said, fine, skip, toodaloo, just return my two G's first. He said he didn't have it. The jerk had lost it in a game, too. In fact, he was coming back to ask for more money to finance his bus ticket. Well, I lowered the boom on him. I told him I hadn't spent the last 4 years in a goddamn hellhole, only to come back and get taken for a sucker by a guy I thought was my friend. Then you know what he did? He started laughing. He laughed, and he called me a sucker for going off to fight. He actually said I was an idiot for allowing myself to be drafted. He said everyone who served in uniform was a fool, and those who died were the biggest fools of all. Sanders pulled out a cigarette and lit it with a shaking hand. I snapped, Sarge, he went on. I got so mad I grabbed an empty motor oil bottle and broke it over his head. All I wanted to do was stop his laughing. I didn't want to kill him. But he fell down and then he started twitching and then he fell still. But there was glass all over the place and when I was picking it up, he fought back. It fought back. He lifted his bandaged finger. I should have lammed right then and there, but I didn't have any money either. I had to finish up a job on a Nash just to get paid enough to keep eating for another week. I worked all night with Lai's body sprawled out on the floor a few feet away. I used a work lamp, because I was afraid if I turned on the light, somebody might come in. Then the next morning you showed up and saw the body before I had the chance to dump it somewhere, and here we are. Here we are. Everything you told me up to now was a lie, Goody. You played me for a chump. You probably laughed at me behind my back, too. No, I swear. Look, just let me go, okay? If you have to tell your friend the cop, at least give me a couple of days to disappear before you do it. I can't, Goody. You've killed a man. Jesus, Sarge, so have you. It's not like we didn't kill people in the war. In the war, we had no choice. Now we do. It's different. Only thing different are the uniforms of the enemy. Sanders said bitterly. Come on, Sarge, give me a break. After everything we went through together, the cold, the mud, the fatigue, the bullets, the bombs, old blood and guts yelling at us like we were fighting dogs, all you got to do is lower the gun, turn around, and walk out of here. Would that really be so hard? A sudden loud pounding came to the door, which startled Sanders. It's open, Detective, Jim called. Rand Moreland and two uniformed officers entered the room, guns drawn. Turning back to Sanders, Jim said, No, Corporal, it wouldn't be that hard. And then lowered his gun, turned around, and walked out of there. The end. This story is called Second Chance by Kevin Egan. Fox believed he kept a mental file on every employee at the New York County Courthouse. Like many of his beliefs, this one did not bear up under scrutiny. Richard Heiser, said Bev. Who? Said Fox. Bev was in her office near the southern tip of Manhattan. Fox, exhaling the last drag from his first cigarette of the day, was several subway stops uptown on the courthouse portico. It was just after 9 a.m. The daily tide of people with court business washed up the wide limestone steps and streamed through the revolving door. Richard Heiser, Bev repeated. Dicky to his friends, he is a senior court attorney in the law department, just sent you his photo. Fox immediately recognized the harried soul he'd often seen scurrying around the courthouse, pigeon-toed and pot-bellied, his tie askew and his soft-soled shoes dusty. So that's Dicky Heiser, huh? I never knew his name. He's gone missing, said Bev. And this is our problem, said Fox? Not exactly, said Bev, but the man who reported him missing thinks it is. Half an hour later, Fox cupped his eyes to the small glass panel in the studded leather door of the courtroom, where Honorable Edmund Greenstreet presided. Inside, a lawyer gripping a podium confronted a witness fidgeting on the stand. A court reporter straddled her steno machine, fingers stroking the keys. A dozen citizens slouched in the jury box. Judge Greenstreet himself sat sideways on the bench, and angled his side to maximize the effect of his comb-over. His big leather chair leaned back precipitously, and his hands gestured as if he were pontificating to the lawyers huddled around the counsel's table. The judge's law clerk leaned casually against the sidebar. She glanced toward the door, locked eyes with Fox through the glass, then straightened her posture. Fox knew an invitation when he felt one, so he pushed his way into the courtroom. The judge, indeed, was pontificating on some fine point of evidence, illustrated by Shakespearean allusions. The law clerk met Fox at the rail. Inspector General sent me, said Fox. I will tell him, said the law clerk. She was young and attractive, and if Fox knew nothing else about Judge Greenstreet, it was that he only hired law clerks who were young and attractive. The law clerk needed a full minute to get the judge's attention. Fox recognized a judge on an oratorical roll when he heard one, but after her brief whisper, the judge immediately called a recess and descended from the bench. The law clerk beckoned Fox into the robing room. Judge Greenstreet circled behind his desk, a vantage point that allowed him to look Fox up and down like a rancher in the market for a horse. He's a court officer, he said to his clerk. You told me he was from the Inspector General's office. He is, she said. I am, said Fox. The judge frowned as if assessing the truth of an incredible assertion. That will be all, he told his clerk. She went back into the courtroom, the judge staring after her until the door closed. He had a reputation as a man who brimmed with erudition and wit in public, but was a sourpuss in private. He sank into his chair and simultaneously into his sourpuss mood. Well, assuming you are in fact from the Inspector General, then I suppose you are here about Dickie. The judge loosened the collar of his robe. Dickie and I go back a long way. Law school, in fact. The law never was meant to be computerized. Sad to see how progress utterly destroyed Dickie's singular talent. Which is, said Fox. He was a wordsmith. A wordsmith par excellence. We judges in this courthouse write upwards of 30,000 decisions each year. But those decisions are really just our opinions on the law. They mean nothing until they are translated into court orders. Easy? Most of the time. Problematic? Sometimes. Critical? In the most important cases. That is where Dickie's star truly shone. He was adept at transforming the most complicated and abstruse opinions into ironclad orders. But now those orders are spit out by AI, or whatever it's called. And to see poor Dickie relegated to wandering the courthouse like a man without a country, it's just sad. Are you saying he may have committed suicide, said the judge? No, nothing so dramatic. Dickie is one of the most stable men I know. All I can say is what I reported to the IG last week. Dickie called to set up a lunch date at a restaurant on West Broadway in Tribeca. I went there, waited and waited. He never showed up. He never called to apologize or explain, and I have not been able to reach him since. That is very unlike Dickie. The law department was a pool of several dozen staff attorneys who gave legal advice to judges on a case-by-case basis. The nerve center of the department was the office of the chief court attorney. The office had an open-door policy which allowed Fox to breeze in silently. The chief, Tom Naughton, was deep in concentration, but dropped the hand that shielded his eyes when he sensed Fox looming over his desk. "Oh, my God, what brings you here?" he said. Fox relaxed his facial muscles to take the edge off his challenging, blue-eyed stare. "I'm looking for Dickie Heiser," he said. Naughton lifted a sheaf of pink phone message slips and waved them at Fox. "You and half the judges in the building," he said. "Some habits die hard. Why do you need him?" "There have been inquiries," said Fox. "That's all I'm allowed to say. Does he have an office?" "Did, but not anymore. Not since the AI thing." "I know all about that," said Fox, even though he didn't. "Never used his office that much anyway," said Naughton. He was on permanent call with the judges, circling constantly through the rarefied air of the chamber's floors. Not all legal problems involve analyzing facts or researching the law. Many involve non-legal practicalities. Dickie is a master at devising ingenious solutions to sticky problems. So how do the judges find him if he has no office? And no cell phone to boot, Naughton grinned. He wears a beeper on his belt, probably the last man alive to own one. Fox peered through the tiny glass panel into Judge Greenstreet's courtroom as the morning session of the trial was wrapping up. The jury was still seated. The attorneys were gathered around counsel's table, and the judge seemed to be instructing everyone on how the rest of the day would proceed. The law clerk, Fox had discovered that her name was Loretta Stevens, stood sidebar. Inevitably, she glanced in Fox's direction. He held her eye, then nodded before breaking away. Half an hour later, Fox flicked his third cigarette of the day over the railing on the north end of the courthouse portico. Loretta still hadn't joined him, and he worried that he was losing his touch, that the intensity of his stare had weakened. He was just about to light up his fourth cigarette an hour ahead of schedule when Loretta placed her hand on the railing. "Have another one of those?" she said. Fox shook one from his pack, lit hers, then lit his own. It didn't take much effort to start Loretta talking. For anyone on a judge's staff, the judge was always topic A. Loretta said she was truly honored to be working for Judge Greenstreet. His reputation as one of the finest jurists in the entire state court system was the reason court administrators often steered the toughest, most newsworthy cases his way. These high-profile cases brought a lot of attention and a cachet to her job as a law clerk, but they also brought the pressure of the media, which rarely grasped the nuances of the law, and therefore often mischaracterized those nuances. Judge Greenstreet kept his law clerks for two-year terms, and she was nearing the end of hers. Just as well, she told Fox, because the judge was stressed out both in court and at home. "How so?" said Fox. "He has a wife and three daughters, each of them very demanding and very needy." "Demanding and needy how?" said Fox. "One daughter is getting married. One is graduating from law school and the other is graduating from college, all in the same month. And each is expecting her own gala celebration, said Loretta. The wife is a fashion plate. Sensing the acid in Loretta's tone, Fox changed the subject to the judge's lunch date with Dickie Heiser. Nothing special about it, said Loretta. They have lunch once a month, usually on the last Friday. The lunch is always at the same restaurant and always arranged by Dickie, who calls on the Wednesday to confirm the arrangements. Kind of funny, really, like an old married couple, and at least Dickie makes no demands on the judge. Does Dickie call Chambers or the judge's cell phone? The judge is an analog type of guy. Doesn't carry a cell phone because he'd be hounded half to death. By who? Said Fox. Loretta smirked as if citing her earlier comments. Anyway, she said, Chambers has two landlines, a public line and private line. The judge uses the private line exclusively for his own calls. I'm not allowed to answer it, even if I'm the only one in Chambers. So when Dickie called on Wednesday to confirm the lunch date, it would have been on the private line? Almost certainly, said Loretta. She took one last drag and flicked the cigarette away. If that's everything, I need to get back to work. It wasn't much, but it was the only thing approaching a lead that Fox could pursue. Luckily, he had a passkey. Every court officer at 60 Center Street had a passkey that would open courtrooms and back offices. But only Fox, owing to his role as an undercover investigator for the Inspector General, had a passkey that would open a judge's chambers. At close of business, Fox posted himself on a park bench across the street from the courthouse. At 6 p.m., Loretta descended the courthouse steps and headed toward the subway entrance. Half an hour later, Judge Greenstreet backed his Cadillac out of the long driveway reserved for the very few judges who still commuted by car. Chambers was quiet. The air was completely still and carried traces of perfume mingling with pipe tobacco. Fox knew that the courthouse landlines automatically logged all incoming and outgoing calls. He dialed into the phone log for Judge Greenstreet's private line and began to scroll backwards in time. The log showed repeated calls from four different numbers. Undoubtedly, as Loretta promised, from the judge's wife and three daughters. There was one call from an extraneous number that came in at 1 p.m. on the Wednesday before Dickie Heiser went missing. Fox returned to the same park bench and phoned Bev. And you want me to find out where Dickie was calling from? Where is that going to get us? Maybe nowhere, but it's all I got, said Fox. It's going to take some time with all the triangulations and such. Did I mention that Dickie doesn't own a cell phone, said Fox. Fox returned to the same park bench and phoned Bev. So you think you identified the phone call from Dickie Heiser to Judge Greenstreet, said Bev. And you want me to find out where Dickie was calling from? Where is that going to get us? Maybe nowhere, but it's all I got, said Fox. Sorry, I read this part. Did I mention that Dickie doesn't own a cell phone, said Fox. The Broadway Bar building was exactly what the name implied, a skyscraper stacked with lawyers. There were large firms, small firms, tiny boutique firms, satellite offices of national firms, and suites of solo practitioners who banded together to share overhead. The ornate lobby looked like something out of a film noir with its marble floor, wooden pillars, leather furniture, lush potted plants, and a gleaming bank of highly varnished wooden phone booths with accordion glass doors. According to Bev, Dickie's call to Judge Greenstreet's chambers came from one of the phone booths. Fox went down the line, inspecting the phone number in each booth. May I help you, sir? Fox turned to find a security guard staring down at him. I'm from the Inspector General's office, said Fox, flashing his court officer's shield. Neither the IG's office nor his silver shield carried any authority outside the court system, but invoking them usually worked. This time was no exception. Is there security camera footage covering these booths? Said Fox. I believe so, said the security guard. The images were grainy, but clear enough for Fox to identify Dickie Heiser as the person who closed himself into the phone booth and then exited a minute later, shortly after 1 p.m. on that Wednesday. Now that I think of it, said the guard, I've seen him come into the building before. How often? Often enough that I took notice. After an hour of fast-forwarding, often enough resolved into midday, on what was always the last Wednesday before the last Friday of the month. The Broadway Bar building, said Tom Naughton. That's a hike from here. Monthly? We only went back 6, said Fox, but yeah. Well, said Naughton, he could be looking for a new job. and 6 months ago was about when the courts adopted the AI program. Dickie quickly saw the writing on the wall. Fox opened his phone to the photo of the Broadway Bar Building's tenant directory. "Oh, yeah, there are several national firms here," said Naughton as he tacked around the expanded photo. "This one specializes in asbestos claims. This one in environmental claims. This one in prescription drug injuries. Watch 10 minutes of daytime TV and you'll see their ads. Any of them would be interested in someone with Dickie's knowledge and courthouse connections." The desk phone rang, and Naughton excused himself to answer. "I'll tell him," he said, and hung up. "Loretta Stevens, she asks that you come up to Chambers." Chambers was a typical three-office suite. An avenue of open doors connected the outer office, staffed by Loretta, with an inner office staffed by an absent secretary, and finally with Judge Greenstreet's private chamber, where the judge sat with his big leather chair turned sideways. He had his phone pressed to one ear and an open hand covering his other ear. Even at a distance, Fox sensed the phone conversation was serious. "Looks like you are inundated with work," said Fox. Loretta's desk was piled with dozens of folders. Each folder represented a formal motion Judge Greenstreet needed to decide. Loretta groaned. "I'm too young to remember the days of impact typewriters," she said, "but they had the virtue of being too clumsy and slow to produce lengthy sets of papers. Computers certainly promote more motions and thicker submissions." "And a heftier bottom line for the firms," said Fox. "Personally, I don't know how any chambers can keep up with the volume." "We have a strict division of labor," said Loretta. "The most complex motions go to the law department. I draft decisions in all cases dealing with insurance claims, real estate disputes, landlord-tenant issues, and motor vehicle accidents. The judge handles all the motions in newsworthy cases like political issues and celebrity divorces. At first, I also drafted all the routine procedural decisions, but a few months ago he took them from me because I'm overwhelmed and he says he needs a mental break from the high-powered stuff." At that moment, the judge's phone conversation erupted. "I know I said so, just not now. Have I ever not? Soon, I hope." Loretta circled out from behind her desk and closed the door to the middle office. "He wanted me to ask you if you've learned anything about Dickie," he said. "Not much," said Fox. "Except the call to Chambers that day was from a payphone in the Broadway Bar Building." He waited a beat for Loretta to react. She didn't. It's downtown, several blocks from here, and several more from the restaurant." "I live in the suburbs," said Loretta. "This courthouse is about as far downtown as I ever travel." And this is the end of this story for this week. I will continue this next Monday on June 8th. This is Mary Lee for Talking Information Radio.